Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Monday, November 20th, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in to watch our program on WVW-TV this morning. We're thankful to be here in this week of Thanksgiving. As you know, this is Thanksgiving week in the United States, and it's a big holiday week, and so the news tends to be more introspective or reflective rather than breaking headlines, because I think most news makers are out busy celebrating Thanksgiving week or deer hunting or whatever turns it on. So anyway, thank you for watching. As you know, we are a sponsored network here at WVW-TV. We rely on the generosity of you, our viewers, to support this programming. As you know, we don't have a paywall and we don't have subscriptions. Our programming is free and it's 24 hours a day. So you can watch us live or pre-recorded. And at the end of the day, there are tremendous reasons to be watching WVW-TV, because we bring alternative viewpoints and very clear viewpoints to the idea of the marketplace of ideas, and that adds to the greatness of our American economy and our American culture. So thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. If you feel like helping out in this time of giving, you can certainly go to the WVW-TV Foundation and make a donation, and that of course helps us keep programming rolling along. Free programming, no paywalls. We also have sponsors, of course, for our network. We don't sell commercials, but we do have sponsors who are very kind and help us stay online. And of course, the sponsor for my program is Swiss America Trading, which is a great American company based in Arizona. And they make a market in precious metals. They're a vendor of precious metals. So if you're thinking about adding to your holdings or your portfolio, and you're looking for a company to do business with, that trusted company, certainly Swiss America would fit the bill. You can reach out to them at 1-800-519-6271. And you can call them and ask them for some free information about the precious metal sector. We're happy to share with you. No pressure, no salesman will call. But it's very interesting to know more about precious metals investing. You can also go to their website at SwissAmerica.com and look around, shop around. And if you use the promo code EASTMAN, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, you will be able to not only purchase precious metals, but they also have a special going on right now that's really worth thinking about. Right now, they're offering silver half-dollar coins at the low price of $13.50, and that includes shipping. And if you know anything about buying online, and especially heavy things online, the shipping can be a burden. But here, with this offer, they're offering $13.50 each for the standing Liberty half-dollar coins, and includes shipping to your home, your business, your office. So if you're thinking about adding to your portfolio, you want to add a little more silver, or you're thinking of what to get your relatives, your nieces, nephews, children, grandchildren, Uncle Mortimer, whatever, you can certainly think about these as make excellent gifts, excellent stocking stuffers. But more importantly, when you give the gift of precious metals, you're giving something precious that people will not use and throw away into the landfill. They will keep them, because that's what people do with precious things. So if you're thinking about it, if you're thinking about adding to your collection, or if you're thinking about buying something for that hard to purchase for a relative or a friend, here you go. This is a great idea at $13.50, including shipping. As you can see on the screen, these are bullion coins. And the way a lot of people will buy tangible precious metals that they can hold in their hands and secure themselves is in bullion form like this. And these governments around the world, it happens to be United States Mint that you're seeing on the screen, but they will make a standardized coin, a standard amount of gold quantity, and then quality is important as well. And when you buy bullion coins that are minted by the U.S. government and other governments, you know that you're getting at least what you paid for, which is a certain amount and quality of gold or silver or platinum. It's a great way to hold precious metals. So again, and it's also a very nice gift. gift. So if you're thinking about adding to your collection, or if you're looking for something a little bit special, give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271, or go to their website, swissamerica.com, use the promo code EASTMEN, and take advantage of these specials. So thank you so much to Swiss America for sponsoring my program and WVW-TV in general. We appreciate their sponsorship, and I'm sure they would appreciate you giving them a look. So, okay, let's move on to the news. And as I said, it's certainly the start of a holiday weekend. I'll be on live today and tomorrow, and then we're going recorded through the end of the week. But I wanted to share the news that is. And, of course, the big news internationally today, and this is sort of an interesting result, is that the election in Argentina, they were electing a new president this week, and, of course, the big news is that a libertarian candidate has won the election, which is very interesting, because you have the long-term traditional situation in Argentina where a very famous old politician, now long since passed away, by the name of Perón, was basically the leader of Argentina. Some would say a visionary leader, others would say a dictator. But Mr. Perón was, in fact, the leader of Argentina for a very long time. And then his wife became famous. They actually did a Broadway play, Evita Perón. She was the leader for a while. And then It has moved on to this Peronist party, and this tends to be what we would consider more of a left-leaning party in Argentina. But Argentina is an interesting place, and it goes back deep into history. And I want to just roll the clock back just a little bit. If you remember back in the day, we had Christopher Columbus, this Italian fellow who was working for the king and queen of Spain, Isabella and Ferdinand, and they basically paid him to go sail off the end of the world and see if he could figure out a way to get to India by going west rather than sailing around to Asia, India, and China, and going the other way. So Christopher Columbus set off with three ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and he sailed off, not sure if he was going to fall off the edge of a flat world or find something else. And of course, crossing the Atlantic Ocean, he bumps into what he perceived as being India, like with the Hindus. Okay, so the idea was that, oh, these must be the Hindi or the Indians, and that's where the name Indians comes from in the United States. They were only off by half a globe. But at the end of the day, when Chris shows up, he plants the flag of Spain, and everything South America, Central America is declared the dominion of the Spanish kings. They basically showed up and said, oh, this is ours, we'll take it. And that began the colonization of I guess we can say South America, Central America, Latin America, Spanish and American. But at the end of the day, this became a big thing. And of course, because the Spanish had taken the risk in hiring Chris to go sail across the ocean blue in 1492, he was able to secure a great deal of gold and silver that was being mined by the local native tribes, of course. And by sequestering these precious metals and bringing them back to Spain, Spain became a very, very wealthy country. And of course, it made other kingdoms or queendoms like England and France and the Austrian Empire a little bit nervous, because Spain wasn't running around digging up its own gold and silver. It was bringing it over in boatloads from this new world. And of course, that also piqued the interest of exploration in the New World, not the least of which the British, who figured out, boy, there's gold in them there hills. And off they settled to Virginia and Plymouth Rock and Massachusetts Bay Colony, and the rest, of course, is history. Well, the Spanish-American world evolved politically in a much different way than the English and French New Worlds. So the French came and, of course, grabbed Quebec and all the parts, the hinterland, and the Dutch showed up and they grabbed what became Manhattan, and the English grabbed New England and the southern areas. So suddenly you have European populations throughout the eastern United States, and of course Spain coming up from the south through what we now call Mexico and up into basically the western third of the United States, of the territory that consists of the United States. So what happened was there were different political viewpoints, and England, of course, or UK, England, the British, whatever, had a long tradition that started with Magna Carta, which was basically where King John, the grandson of William the Conqueror, had become the king, and a despotic one at that. After 1066, the Battle of Hastings, the Norman invasion, and the Normans took over England, okay, kicked out the Anglo-Saxon kings. And basically, the English barons reeled in King John and forced him to sign Magna Carta, which basically said, hey, we got rights. Okay, you can be the king, but we got rights. And with that emerged the British Parliament. So by the, and this is the 1200s, so by the time the early 1600s roll around, the British view of governance consisted of a king who owned the whole place, and he happened to have his own government, and the government is our House of Parliaments, and then of course the House of Lords, the senior house, was these barons. Okay, they inherited their own, you know, bicameral house. So the point is, when the British showed up in America in the 1600s, and then it led to the 150 some years of British colonialism before the American Revolution, there was a deeply ingrained thought of individual power to the individual, that the king wasn't all powerful, and that individuals had rights. And of course, our whole American Constitution, our whole American experience, the Bill of Rights, people matter, individuals matter, okay? And it's enshrined into the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. And that was not the case in France, and it was not the case at all in Spain. Spain was a much more aggressive society, much more hierarchical. The royal and the noble houses had great political power and economic power. So the part of the New World that was Spanish did not come from the psychology of the British mind that the individuals were, you know, the end all and be all. And of course, they had missed the Protestant Reformation as well, which had a tremendous amount. If you study back in economic history, the Protestant Reformation and its focus on an individual's personal relationship with God rather than through an intermediary of a priesthood, all of that led to a different psychology. So today, when we look at South America, Latin America, Spanish America, whatever, you know, after the Spanish colonial period, these regions broke into individual countries. And of course, Argentina and Ecuador and, you know, El Salvador, all these places, and of course, Brazil being Portuguese, but Portugal and Spain are very culturally the same, okay? So the point is that the philosophy of government in Spanish America is different than British America and French America, but most of the French America has been absorbed into the British concept that emerged from the American Constitution in the 1780s, okay? And so at the end of the day, as we developed 50 independent states, and of course we have a federal government, and you know, there's problems, you know, fiscal problems. The Spanish model is very different because their cultural hierarchy is much more defined. They don't have the egalitarian view that the English model has in North America. They just simply don't have. There is a deeper hierarchy where, you know, if you're in different social classes, and they're much more defined and refined in South America or Spanish America. So, to make a long story short, when Argentina happened, and it's always been a magnet for Europeans that come, there has always been a struggle of a hierarchy within the governance of Argentina that has been somewhat exploitive. Well, along comes Perón. This is a long story, but it's, you know, it's a holiday week if you got time. And Perón comes along, and they start to bring in these more radicalized ideas from the 1850s out of the Frankfurt School of equality through revolution, social revolution. And in effect, what happens is you have a very interesting dynamic with a very wealthy core class and very terrible poverty with the other 80%. I mean, it's a real dichotomy that we don't see in the U.S. I hope we never do see that kind of poverty. So as a result of that, and the Perón Revolution and these Peronist governments that have come from that, there is a real sense of taxing and spending to provide for the poor. And it's provide for the poor. It's not to create economic opportunity so that poor people can come and grow up. It's to continue this perpetuating this class. And this has been a real struggle in Argentina for a long time. And Argentina has attracted a lot of different people, and primarily Spanish. If you look at, you know, a lot of Italian immigration and German immigration, all sorts of conspiracy theories about whether Hitler moved there, you know. But at the end of the day, it's a complicated place. But they've always had sort of a very high spend on public infrastructure to effectively squelch revolution, because they're much more inclined to revolt than go to the election, you know, go to the election booth. So at the end of the day, we've seen this bouncing back and forth. And of course, these Peronist governments have borrowed and spent and triggered inflation, which I've talked about a couple of weeks ago in Argentina. It's like 134% or 133% per year inflation. And of course, that manifests itself in such social unrest that now this libertarian candidate has been elected. And of course, the people are looking for a solution to this massive inflation. But at the same time, there's a massive public expenditure, which is primarily driven by debt. It's not by growing, you know, the vast, amazing resources within Argentina, the country of Argentina. It's an amazing place with, you know, it's just as rich as any place on earth. And what they're trying to do is rebalance that. So now they've elected this libertarian president, and we'll see how it goes. But the interesting thing about it, and this is, I apologize for the digression here, is that he announces today that he would like to replace the Argentine peso with the American dollar. And now here we are talking about the American dollar. We have, you know, 9% inflation, not 133%. And the federal government is printing, our federal government is printing money at a rate that's, you know, it's rather impressive. So I guess, you know, the grass must look a little greener on the other side to the Argentinians. And the idea would be to use the American dollar as their currency, which would have a rather shocking impact on a lot of people when you think about it. And it's not uncommon. I mean, this has happened before. If you think about the Latin American country of Panama, it was created out of Colombia, sort of an American invention, because we thought it'd be a great idea to put a canal in, and we wanted to make sure we controlled that piece of real estate. So that was back in 1903, I think, when Teddy Roosevelt started digging the canal, and they've always used the American dollar. And of course, El Salvador is another country that uses the American dollar as its currency, because they've had a long-standing relationship with the United States, and Ecuador uses it today. But Argentina is a much bigger economy. And the blowback from his suggestion, and he was just elected, you know, 48 hours ago, is that in order to take all the pesos and convert it to American dollars, and keep in mind, people were fleeing the peso into dollars to begin with, it will, those who have dollars will do well, and those who do not will have a very difficult time scraping together enough pesos to buy $1. So it really is not a great economic equalizer, but it would be an economic stabilizer. And my hope is, you know, it's up to them whether they're going to do this or not. But you know, this is the American dollar's got its own issues, and I think while it may be more stable than the peso, where they basically ran the steam out of it, but at the end of the day, we alone, you know, even though we talk about our currency, is still perceived in many places of the world as the dollar standard, the gold standard, and you know, we'll see how that goes. But I think if they were to try that, the social costs would be very, very would be very, very high for the Argentine people. But we'll see. They've elected a new president, and as a libertarian, he steps outside of the Peronist model, and there was, you know, their socialist model, and we'll see where this goes. So I think it's kind of an interesting development this weekend. The U.S. debt. There's a story out today that the U.S. debt held by foreign countries is now only 30% of the outstanding debt. And the story was 10 years ago, it was 43% of America's federal debt from the federal government is held by other countries. Now it's down to 30%. So what it's showing you is that countries around the world, notwithstanding Argentina, are basically trimming their sails, and they're not necessarily as enthusiastic about holding American federal debt as they were. Now, I mean, there's a different, you know, metric involved where 43%, 30%, depends on the float, how much is outstanding. But there is a lot of federal debt outstanding, American federal debt outstanding. So what it's telling me is that while the American Treasury continues to issue debt to fund spending, there is less global demand for that debt. And, you know, it could be that they're just satiated, because keep in mind, if you take the economies of the world, you know, if you look at the United States and you look at Europe as a block, and then you look at Japan, you look at China, you know, those are the top four. You know, how much U.S. debt can you buy? I mean, you know, you basically have to have additional income and savings that you can invest in, you know, something like American debt. But at some point, the ocean becomes too big, and you simply can't buy anymore logically. And that becomes a real issue for the U.S. because the demand for debt, U.S. debt, is a global phenomenon. But it, instead of 43%, it's now down to 30% of all outstanding debt owned by foreigners. So it's telling you that market to place debt is contracting. And that means you have, you know, less places to go. And then where do you go if you really needed to raise debt fast? Well, there's always the, you know, the Federal Reserve and its central bank, and of course it's quantitative easing. This is ultimately the tool that was blessed into being in 2008, and you know, it's always standing there. And I think that's something for us to watch as Americans. There shouldn't be Federal Reserve buying of federal treasuries. There should be a global market for that. And when the Federal Reserve buys it, it's they're printing the dollars out of thin air. That's how they create money. So. Interesting story that I wanted to, you know, highlight a little bit. One of the other interesting stories, I've been trying to track this down. There was a story late last week about, you know, Japanese banks are in trouble. And I thought, you know, that this is part of that critical thinking skills that I push so hard in this lecture series or my programming. I said, you really want to develop a sensitivity to economic stories that are screaming headlines. So I saw this, okay, big Japanese bank in trouble. So that doesn't sound right to me. Let me do some research. And it's an interesting phenomenon. And I do have time to talk about this Japanese phenomenon, because Japan is a very fascinating country. It's of course, it's very old. And it's been around, you know, as part of world history for a very long time. As a matter of fact, I did a quick search, and it looks like about 2,300 years ago, a group of people came from mainland China onto these islands that we call Japan, and settled in, and there were some indigenous populations. So always, you know, you always land on an island, there's a few local natives, and then you take the place over, plant your flag, you know. But this is 2,300 years ago when the chrysanthemum throne was founded by this group of people that came over. So I guess you could call these settlers proto-Chinese, although I think the Japanese are very, very sensitive. They watch what's happening in Taiwan and say, oh, no, we're not Chinese, we're Japanese. And anyway, so for 2,300 years, Japan has been a very insular place, and of course, it is a remarkable society. It's fascinating. It's a culture unto itself in all the world. And when you think of relatively modern times in the 1800s, the United States wanted to do business with Japan, and we actually sent warships over to force them to do that. Or, you know, opened up the harbor, and then we started doing trading with Japan. Okay, and Japan had wanted nothing to do with anybody. They were perfectly happy to live in their little island. And at the end of the day, Japan has been a very unique place. And of course, when we think of the Japanese situation of World War II, with their vision of perhaps going back the other way and grabbing some of the mainland, which didn't turn out well. And of course, the disaster of World War II on the Japanese, and of course, the unleashing of nuclear bombs on the Japanese, which is to this day, they're the only country that's ever been nuked. But at the end of the day, post-war Japan, the chrysanthemum throne still exists, and the emperor still exists, but Japan went into hyperdrive to modernize itself. And of course, we all know the story, and especially people my age, that when you were growing up, when somebody said it was made in Japan, that was like, that's cheap junk, that's your bots made Japan. Well, that suddenly merged and moved away to becoming probably the finest manufacturers on earth, not only of electronic equipment, but automobile equipment, automobiles. And Japan, of course, is now, I think, the second largest economy in the world, but it still remains a very insular place. And they don't have open borders, and people in Japan, you don't just move to Japan. I mean, it's a very complicated society. The emperor still exists, and the emperor is a symbolic person today. But as it's been explained to me by Japanese friends, his job is to perform the rituals of being Japanese, so that at all times there is the emperor performing what it means to be Japanese. And it's kind of an interesting thing. You can't imagine the President of the United States sitting around being president, just so everybody's happy that there's an American sitting around being American. But Japan is a very well-structured place, and they have a very long view of history. And their banking system is very, very tightly controlled. Their corporations are tightly controlled, and it's very homogenous. It's not an e pluribus unum type thing where out of many come one, out of one come Japan, okay? And at the end of the day, they don't make banking mistakes that are difficult. So I was checking into this. And of course, they've had quantitative easing since the 1980s, and they have really ramped it up. I mean, their debt is like 400+% of their GDP, and everybody on earth is watching, wondering when the Japanese thing will explode. And I suspect culturally it will not, because Japan has a very long view. They tend to look at business planning over 100 years rather than two quarters. And at the end of the day, they don't make mistakes too often, and they don't take crazy risk. So the question was, where does this, where is this bank trouble coming from? And what I've been able to determine is that as for 30 years they've been doing quantitative easing, it's not really helped. The Japanese economy has been pretty flatline. Population has been zero growth, if not declining. And at the end of the day, what was supposed to have helped Japan in the 1980s, the 90s, the aughts, the teens, was this idea that the federal government would just spend whatever it takes to maintain Japanese society, very culturally classic. And the Federal Bank would buy whatever they had to buy to make sure it all happened. And it did happen. And it's a petri dish of economic policy that simply doesn't work anywhere else. And a lot of other places, including the United States, with quantitative easing, buying federal debt, we've got all sorts of problems. But Japan basically is very, very stable. So what was the question? Why is this bank failure thing? Well, apparently the Bank of Japan is their central bank, and they've warned their banks that when you're buying for your reserves, be careful of foreign debt, because like with the American federal treasury debt, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch are downgrading that debt, and there's risk. And that's one thing Japanese are very, very good at, analyzing risk over the long haul. So my sense is, when you talk about Japan as a country and a banking system, they're looking at taking and diversifying their economy. It's starting to come out of this 30-year funk because of this quantitative easing. But I think the story emerged from the fact that they're warning their banks, don't go jumping into American and European debt. Be very careful, because those economies are not secure. And I think that's where that story came from. Okay, well, I'm out of time for today. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got a few more things to talk about. Again, enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend. Thank you so much for tuning into the Eastman Financial Report and WBW TV, and have a great afternoon. Bye.